I'd like to welcome you today to our continuing interview set of interviews on writing and the disciplines. Today we are featuring Robert McKinnon from the Geography Department. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks.
Well, you suddenly got serious on us. What's the first advice you give somebody when they're coming into your geography class and they're faced with the very first paper? Let's take a hypothetical first-year student.
Well, I think in first year, I think student has to become aware of some of the materials that you can use to construct an essay with. And I think to get used to, first year especially, I think to get used to using atlases and data and basically analyzing and summarizing the patterns inherent in data, I think is something that I try to promote particularly in my first year course.
So you're focusing on context primarily
in first year. I think it's more to introduce students to the availability of materials out there and where you can actually find data and information that will help you understand a topic.
Are you terribly fussy then about the way it's organized and presented in essay form?
I am, in terms of first year. In terms of when I read the essay, I really try to go through and make comments about structure and organization. But as far as my teaching goes, I do not spend a great deal of time in terms of here is how to go about constructing an essay. However, I do that in my more advanced course.
Now, you mentioned constructing an essay, and you've been kind enough to give us a handout, which is, I assume, something that you give to your students here.
Yes.
It's entitled Doing Research and Writing About It, or Steps in Constructing an Essay. Do you want to take us through that and let us know in quite specific terms the advice you give to your own students?
Okay, well, maybe before, rather than walk through it step by step, I think one thing I look for in an essay, this would be a third-year essay, one thing I'm looking for is a tight introduction which states the general topic, identifies the sources that are being used, and then presents a bit of a roadmap for the essay. Which sections are going to be discussed in the paper? What three or four areas in particular are you going to look at? And in there, usually in the first paragraph or the second paragraph, somewhere at the beginning of the essay, I look for what I call a statement of purpose. Now, some people call that a thesis statement. Some people call it an hypothesis, depending upon your perspective. But I simply call it a statement of purpose, where in its boldest sense, it's this paper will examine. And I've heard some students say, well, my English teacher tells me not to do this. And it doesn't have to be as boldly stated like that.
But you don't mind it if it's stated in very straightforward
terms. No, I don't. In fact, one of the papers that I brought, you asked me to bring some papers of my own, some examples of other works. One of my own papers that I brought, it's one of the fondest papers that I like that I've written myself. This is one that was in this little book on the Maritimes, and it's really a sort of a mid-19th century overview of agriculture, and right at the very beginning of the second paragraph, I have a statement. This paper begins to fill in our knowledge of farming in the 1850s by examining crop and livestock patterns and identifying types of farming zones, period. Mm-hmm. Very simple, to the point. Now, not always will a thesis or a purpose statement be laid out in those simple terms, and it doesn't necessarily have to be. In fact, a good writer will sometimes sort of have the statement of purpose stated in a perhaps a less bold sort of way that just becomes apparent to the reader as you get through the two paragraphs.
Last day we were talking with John Belshaw from History, and he made similar observations, I think, about the need to focus on a problem and resolve a problem within an essay, your statement of purpose or a hypothesis. But he seemed much more concerned about the means of expression. He continually made, this won't surprise you, Robert, he continually made literary allusions and compared the writing of history to a narrative art form. What I'm hearing from you is that although those may be issues of some importance, they're sort of peripheral to the job of a geographer?
I think so, and I think, as is indicated in my handout, I think one of the perhaps the differences that distinguish geography from history, even though human geography in particular is written in a narrative form, mm-hmm. is that I think there's more of a spatial component to geography. There is the interest in place, community, region, and in some respects, a portion of the paper may be devoted to describing the region, sort of so much of human geography, and I'm sure my students who've read materials on my course reserve list in my third year historical geography course will agree. I think some historical geography is quite descriptive of places and so on. Doesn't necessarily mean it's divorced from addressing a problem, mm-hmm. or a significant historical or contemporary issue.
Can you define that term spatial a little bit more for us? Because that's something that hasn't been introduced before. The notion of writing as being spatial?
Well, maybe a good way to do it would be to pick some examples. You asked me to bring an example of a paper written by another geographer that I thought was a good example of writing. And I picked a paper. It's an older paper written in 1980, written in a journal of forest history. And the title of the paper, it's by Graham Wynn from the University of British Columbia, and the title of the paper is Deplorably Dark and Demoralized Lumberers, Rhetoric and Reality in the Early 19th Century New Brunswick. And I think this paper sort of combines the sort of issues with good geographical description. And so he starts his essay by saying many 19th century authors were critical of the North American lumber industry and of those who participate in it. Some condemned lumbering as an uncertain, itinerant business that led people to live at risk upon the capital instead of the annual produce of the country. Others denounced the harmful social effects of forest employment. In their view, lumbering drew people away from home and substituted alternate bouts of toil and indolence, hardship and debauchery for consistent industry and the good social effects consequent upon being surrounded by women, etc. He's quoting from 19th century sources, which is sort of giving his paper a sense of what sort of the 19th century views of people engaged in the lumbering industry were like.
Now, so far, it sounds to me like a history paper.
Okay,
that same kind of description is something that we focused on with John Belshaw.
It's very, very descriptive, and I think situating the context of the paper, establishing sort of the temporal context of the paper, then he breaks his paper down. He looks at the rhetoric, and he examines why 19th century writers felt that lumberers, people involved in the lumbering industry, were in a sense not contributing to the growth of a mature society or a mature community, so to speak. And then he goes on and he examines the rhetoric of it. Later in the paper, he has a section which he calls Reality, Lumbering and Farming in Early 19th Century New Brunswick. And here is where I think the paper switches from more of a historical narrative to a sort of a spatial narrative. Despite the importance of the timber trade in the provincial economy, New Brunswick was far from the extensive lumber camp that some have envisaged. Rural dwellers formed the majority of its steadily increasing population, which rose from some 25,000 early in the century to approximately 200,000 by 1851. And then he goes through, at mid-century, approximately 30,000 people lived in the port city of St. John. Fredericton, the capital, had fewer than 5,000. Clusters of 2,000 or 3,000 people lived in small urban centers along the lower reaches of the St. Croix and Miramichi valleys. Elsewhere, villages served a population dispersed about the coasts and along the major river valleys of the province. A thin line of settlement along the southwest Miramichi River linked the peripheral population of the Gulf Shore to the more densely populated ribbon of land flanking the St. John Valley. In other words, he moves from sort of addressing the problem of how people talked about the lumbering industry in the 19th century to here's what mid-19th century New Brunswick was like. Mm-hmm. And that's how he constructs the rest
of his
essay.
What strikes me from what you've just read, apart from the notion of a temporal dimension and a spatial dimension, of all aspects of description and descriptive writing, is the attention to detail that's there. Powers of observation are presumably important as you're studying geography?
Yes. And that goes back to my comment earlier about trying to introduce first-year students to maps. I mean, one of the key tools of geographers is the map. And I think, you know, if you read the pages of the Canadian Historical Review, if you find maps and illustrations in those articles, I would say there's probably a chance that that article was written by a geographer or a historian with geographical leanings. And so I think the map is a key tool, and I think also map interpretation is a skill. It's a skill like analyzing data, like learning how to present data in particular formats, establishing particular sort of social science tests on data. Mm-hmm. Reading maps and understanding maps and how they're constructed, I think, is a skill that it's one of the tools of geography.
Well, you're talking about the tools of geography, and you introduced this visual dimension here when you talk about maps. And I noticed from the samples of writing that you gave me, there's also older photographs included in there as well. Can you talk a little bit about using visuals in the writing of essays? Do you look for your students to include a visual dimension? And what are some of the difficulties, too, about getting such things as permissions, copyright permission, for including such materials?
Okay, well, maybe it's a good time to talk a little bit about the two student papers that I brought with me, just to show that I'm not totally ensconced in Maritime Canada, even though much of my writing is about the Maritimes. I've chosen two papers, one of which is on the Maritimes by one of our well-known students from a few years ago. Some of you may remember a student named Darcy Stainton. I'm sure he wouldn't mind me mentioning that. He wrote a paper on what he called the economic crisis of the Nova Scotia coal industry, 1921 to 1951. And it's a very data-based paper. He basically collected census data, mining record data, and graphed it and looked at trends in the coal industry. And I think he really did an excellent job in terms of laying out the data and generating an hypothesis about the data.
Mm-hmm. Which he's presenting visually in the paper.
Which he's presenting very clearly in the paper. And I think his first paragraph sort of outlines it. Would you mind if I read just a little bit? As an extraction industry, coal mining is often linked with iron, steel, and electricity. Period. Nice short sentence. While the coal marketplace is undoubtedly dominated by the fate of these secondary industries, the connection is often taken as a complete explanation of the economic situation. Graham Wynn asserts that, quote, inevitably, the fortunes of the coal mining industry reflected developments in iron and steel production, unquote. While this statement is not untrue, it implies that ultimately the economics of Nova Scotia coal production can be traced entirely through its attendant industries. Rather, production and employee data suggest that many factors have determined the success or failure of the coal mines have been internal in origin. That last sentence is his thesis, or its purpose statement, or his thesis statement. He's saying, instead of just the success or failure of the steel industries driving the coal mining industry, he is suggesting that production and employee data indicate that the success or the failure of the coal mining industry may have had some structural internal problems. And that's the thesis he addresses. And he basically looks at productivity levels. He says, well, Nova Scotia mines were of lower productivity than Alberta mines. And he looks through capitalization. He makes the argument that in terms of capitalization, Nova Scotia coal mines embraced technology and the application of capital to the production process later than Alberta and Vancouver Island coal mines did. And so he makes the argument that And in his title, Too Slow to Catch the West is sort of the subtitle of the paper.
That's the verbal part of it. Where's the visual complement?
The visual complement is more in the graphs. He's basically graphically presenting data. He has about 20 pages of graphs which look at various characteristics of the industry, from age distribution of people employed to production levels, comparing Alberta and Nova Scotia.
Geographers like that kind of thing.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's not as descriptive a paper as the one I read earlier, where you're looking at a particular region, but it's analyzing an industry in that province, and he is comparing it to another province. So there's sort of an implicit geographical element to the paper, the way it's laid out.
I noticed also an allusion to Graham Wynne, which is somebody that you've mentioned yourself several times. Is there a suggestion there that a successful paper might cite sources that have been mentioned in class or are near and dear to the heart of the professor?
I suppose.
Who is Graham Wynne?
I tend to think.
And what role does he play in your courses?
I tend to think I'm a little more objective than that. But there are a few, in terms of historical geography, which is the course that I teach at the third year level, there are a handful of geographers, some of whom are quite prolific, and these include Graham Wynne as well as Cole Harris, both of whom are at UBC, which makes it interesting because, I mean, our textbook, for example, has a chapter by both Graham Wynne and Cole Harris, and I think at least one of the articles on course reserve is by Cole Harris. So, yes, these are local British Columbia geographers. And
you studied with Graham.
Yes, and Graham Wynne was actually my supervisor for my doctoral thesis, which...
And you've written with Graham Wynne.
Yes.
So it was probably a pretty intelligent move on Mr. Sippen's part.
Well, possibly, but I tend to think I'm a little more objective than that. The second paper, though, is not about the Maritimes, and it's about an area near Kamloops. And this is more of a community-based study, and I think this paper is more similar to the paper I read by Graham Wynne about the lumber industry in mid-19th century New Brunswick. Only this is about a small community near Salmon Arm called Notch Hill. And this paper was written by a student named Virginia Courtney, who wrote a paper in Geography 328 for me in 1993. And I really liked this paper. It was a community study. But the way it was situated, it established this small community within the context of British Columbia, British Columbia's development. Would you mind if I read just a little bit?
Just before you do,
okay.
It looks to be an image on the front page, is that true?
There is a map on the front page, which is a map of the very small community, which emphasizes the importance of the railway, because basically Notch Hill is a railway town.
Mm-hmm.
And
it seems to me that if we're talking about distinctions between the various disciplines, you would very, very seldom see a visual complement in an English essay. You might see photographs in particular in a history essay. You would see charts and tables in a sociology paper. And now we're seeing a much greater emphasis, so much so that you seem to take it for granted that there would be an image on the front page.
Yes, not always. I think if, depending upon the topic, if your paper is explicitly spatial and you're dealing with patterns on the landscape, so to speak, then I think a map is necessary. A community study, I think it really is useful to provide a map to show this is where the community is located or this is what it looks like, even if it's just a location map. That is one thing I emphasized in my second year Geography of Canada course. In terms of the term essay, every term essay must have a map to show me the region that they're discussing in the essay. And so it emphasizes what you've said. But if I could read just the first paragraph of this again, and I really like this essay. Throughout the province of British Columbia, a major period of settlement and agricultural expansion followed the construction of the CPR. Many small communities emerged in the late 1880s in direct response to the needs of the new transcontinental transportation system. Situated approximately 28 kilometers northwest of Salmon Arm in the Shuswap Lake area, the community of Notch Hill owes its inception to the Canadian Pacific Railway. The rugged topography of the area required engine pushers to push the freight trains and pull the passenger trains up the steep 1.9% grade from Tappan and Chase, where passengers and freight were unloaded and dispersed to the surrounding areas. Period.
That 1.9% grade is important, isn't it?
It is, and that's the key in terms of why this community came into being, is that it was located on this rather steep grade along the CPR, which required the establishment of freight pushers to be established in that community to drive the engines up the hill, mm-hmm. and that's why this community came into being. And this is just a wonderful essay. In addition to sort of situating the community and describing the community, she then goes out and interviews four people who live in the community. She talks to them about their experience, and in particular, she talks about the changes that took place after diesel trains were introduced, which reduced the need for pushers. The last sentence of her second paragraph: the community of Notch Hill persisted as a bustling community from the late 1890s to the early 1950s, when the diesel engine replaced the coal engine, rendering the pushers obsolete. And so the rest of the essay deals with the attempts by Notch Hill to sustain itself as a marginal agricultural community, mm-hmm. a small-scale agricultural community providing foodstuffs to the local area. And it's just a wonderful lesson but in addition to situating sort of the context of this small BC community, she actually goes out and interviews these four people who operated farms during this period and talked about the problems they faced in terms of marketing and so on.
And that gives you that added dimension, which you've been talking about before, about contextualizing your subject spatially and temporally.
But it's a very nice essay, and it's one of the best sort of local BC essays that I've received in my courses.
But we only have a few minutes left, and it's probably a good idea to turn over to the student panel here and find out what areas we've been missing when it comes to writing in geography or writing geography papers. Maybe it's a good idea to start you off by finding out how many of you have studied geography before. Oh, okay, that's a lot. Do you want to start us off then?
I was going to ask you, is there a difference in writing historical geography compared to urban or environmental geography?
I would like to say I don't think there is a difference. I think
look on your face.
I think good writing. I think good writing. You know, good writing stands out, and it, you know, I think clean, clear, short sentences, well organized paragraphs. It doesn't matter what the discipline is. One thing I look for, though, and I'll come back to the urban and environmental differences in a moment. One thing I look for when I read an essay is I look for sort of a topic sentence at the beginning of each paragraph or somewhere in the paragraph. And I try to think, well, what is this paragraph telling me? And sometimes I find that's how I identify repeats in a paper. If I'm going through, well, this paragraph is discussing this issue or this topic, but the next paragraph, wait a minute, we're saying the same thing again. And so I can then comment in the margins appropriately. So I look for that as a reader. So it might be something that students should look for when they're constructing the essay. Think about each paragraph and each sentence in each paragraph. But to get back to your question, I think...
Before you do, okay, let's find out what was behind the question.
Because you feel there is a difference between those aspects of the field?
From studying all of them, I do feel that there's a difference in just the way you write, and Robert and I have already discussed the personal, and from what I've discussed with you, the personal isn't really relevant in historical geography, whereas in environmental, me studying environmental geography, it is in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I would
have found that too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Look, yeah. The jury's in here.
Yeah, I would say that I tend to lean more towards sort of the historian's approach to writing, more the narrative style, where you're writing, you know, in a third person, in a present or a past tense, but I would find a bit awkward a sentence, you know, I think that, you know, or my personal view is, I think there's other ways of injecting your own subjective views into a paper without being so blunt.
Okay, how do you do that? Because that's a question that's come up a number of times here, mm-hmm. where we've been discussing not just the personal in terms of the first-person pronoun, but a personal investment in your topic and the subject matter. And how does somebody in second, third year invest themselves personally in a geography paper? How can it become more than an exercise just satisfying course demands?
Well, I think, you know, I think a place to put it would be in your final concluding paragraph, in your paragraph, where you can make subjective comments about the data, the literature that you've read. You know, much of the literature which addresses this topic seems to emphasize this event. In my view, or my paper suggests, as Darcy Staten did, my paper suggests that there are other factors which lie behind this particular event. In Darcy's case, he's saying, well, everybody seems to emphasize the steel industry being the engine of growth for the coal industry. He's saying, well, there's other factors here, and there's other problems. You have to look beyond the connections between the steel industry. And so I see that as sort of, he has injected his personal view, his interpretation, his organization of the data.
By the way, he's contextualizing the subject.
Yes. And so he doesn't come out there and say, you know, I think that Graham Wynn and others are off base. You know, well, he quotes Graham Wynn right at the beginning. I think these authors are off base by drawing too strong a connection. He doesn't say, I think this. But it becomes clear to the reader that that's what he's saying. So in my view, that would be a way to present it. I think you'll find there are some subtle distinctions between urban geography, historical geography, environmental geography. I think urban geography tends to be a little more social scientific, a little more data oriented, a little more here's the method I'm using, here's the statistical problem that I'm addressing, and my paper identifies A, B, and C. It's a little more structured, a little more rigid, perhaps a little less narrative focused. Environmental geography tends to be more issue-oriented, more ecology issue. I mean, I think perhaps the instructors would like to see your opinion on the issue. Where do you stand? Are you committed to, you know, conservation? Are you committed to this particular issue?
It sounds to me like what we're hearing once again is the straddling of two areas, the social sciences and humanities approach, again within a single discipline.
Yes.
And one of the things that's coming through pretty clearly, it seems to me, with this series of interviews, is that no one discipline has one form of essay, that you have to not only learn how to write as a geographer, how to write as a sociologist, as an English major, whatever, but you have to learn how to write within the disciplines and across those disciplines at the same time.
I would agree.
That's fair. Has the discussion here, has it given you a better idea of what would constitute an A paper? Or do you still think there's some magic spell out there that some people know how to cast and others don't?
Yeah. I thought that perhaps I'm used to, especially just writing and getting all these books, especially for history, and getting different interpretations from the academics, but it's rare when you get the opportunity to interview people. I think that's what probably makes such an outstanding paper. The person, you know, whether that person was from that community or not, she still went out there, or he still went out there, and got that those people together, and you know, had to figure out the facts, and you know, mm-hmm. weigh bias perhaps, and still make a good impression, you know, and still use those academics to back up what she was trying to do.
So that is a dimension that you would reward if you saw it in a paper.
Yeah, I thought that was you know, the initiative was unusual, and it was a labor of love for the person who wrote the paper. I think she was from that community initially, and it was, you know, it was clear as you read the paper that this is more than just an exercise to complete a requirement for Geography 328, mm-hmm. and that's what made it, I think, you know, so unusual a paper. It really stood out for the very reasons you've identified, and it was a nice combination of sort of historical literature and sources which backed up, here's why this community came into being, here's the changes that took place when technology changed, and here's what the people remained. And so it was kind of a nice sort of overview from the beginning, and the community still survives, albeit much, much smaller than it was before the 1950s. So you're right, that was unusual. But I've also seen cases. I had a student last year who picked a topic that she knew very little about, and I thought did a pretty good job. She was doing a study of Quebec in the mid-19th century, and it was almost entirely based on a set of primary data. And her job in the term essay was to basically identify patterns and trends in this set of mid-19th century data. And I thought, for, you know, sitting out here in Kamloops without access to an archive other than interlibrary loans and microfilm, I think she did an excellent job situating the context of this sort of bald data, so to speak, in the broader context of what mid-19th century Quebec was like. And she, you know, she had not really known that much about mid-19th century Quebec before she started. So to her credit, it started out as an exercise, but it became a very interesting exercise that I think she did a really good job at. So it doesn't necessarily, to get an A paper or get an A grade in geography doesn't necessarily mean you have to be sort of personally committed to this topic and get as involved as Virginia did. It doesn't hurt, but here was a student who really just did this out of interest. Well, I want to learn how to use some data. I'm interested in mid-19th century Quebec. I've done some reading on mid-19th century Quebec, and she produced, you know, what I consider just a fantastic paper. In terms of her observations about the data, what she thought the data was telling her, and then what other sources suggested about the patterns of the
data. There seems to be a lot of common sense underlying all of this. One of the things that we hear a lot from English departments, especially when we're putting on so-called service courses for professional areas, and we teach writing within those areas, is that people only really do learn how to write once they've got a cause, a purpose, or they've chosen a profession, they find themselves in the workforce, and they're having to write professionally the kinds of things that they need to every day. And it seems to me that's a little bit difficult when you're going from geography at 10 o'clock to English at 11 o'clock and history at 2 o'clock. But it's still important to know that within limits, if you can find some aspect of the subject matter that really does interest you and that you can commit yourself to or try and write like a geographer, learn to write like a geographer, be interested in learning to write like a geographer, you probably will. You probably will succeed. But if you're waiting for geography to come to you, you might have a long wait.
Well, geography also has a problem in that We are one of these disciplines that has a distinct split right down the middle between what's called physical geography, sort of the physical sciences, geomorphology, climatology, and so on, and human geography. And there's a clear split. Now, most of our advanced courses at UCC emphasize the human geography side of the spectrum. I suppose the environmental courses have a little bit of a foot in both camps. But within the discipline at large, there's a very clear distinction. If you pick up a physical geography essay in a journal or a book, it's going to be very scientific. I mean, it could be written by an atmospheric physicist, or it could be written by a climatologist who has a background in geography. And you know, with lots of formulae, lots of data, computer models, etc. But then on the other side of the fence, you have human geography, which ranges from historical geography, which tends to lean a little more toward the historian's approach, but also a range of disciplines like economic geography, which is a little more sort of economics focused, urban geography, which is more planning, city focused, environmental geography, which is more issue ecology and issue focused. So you get these subtle differences. So it's hard to say, you know, even within geography, to say, well, here is the way a geography paper is written. Here is the way, I've given you some examples of historical geography. But I could easily pick some examples out of the Canadian Geographer, which is the journal for geographers. I could pick an urban geography paper, one of which might be really understandable and interesting, particularly for students with a historian's background, but another one that might be almost totally indecipherable because it's about forecasting of population growth and how a city can determine, you know, when it will reach the 100,000 mark and what are the statistical methods that you can use to do it.
I've got a cheeky question.
Okay. So there's differences within the discipline.
I haven't asked this of anybody before. I'm not sure, just one.
Uh-oh. Sure, ask me.
It's what?
It's cheeky.
You were obviously an undergraduate at one point. When you go to graduate school, you focus on a particular area in your master's and your PhD. But as an undergraduate, like everybody, you had to take a full range of courses. Did you do equally well in all the courses that you took?
Put me on the spot. I can tell you the ones I did poorly. I really enjoyed English courses while I was doing my geography degree. And so I found myself in, I suppose, an unusual situation. By the time I was in fourth year, I was taking seminar courses in Canadian literature and other English courses.
You're a good man.
Three quarters of the other students were English majors, and I was sort of the lone geography major in there. Mm-hmm. But I would say I did equally well in English, history, geography. I suffered through courses like French literature and where the lectures were entirely given in French and so on, like everybody else. So I had difficulty in some courses, and I especially remember a French literature course where the whole course was taught entirely in French, and in order to pass, I had to read all the books in English translation. But anyway, and I barely passed. what I remember from my undergraduate degree is I did equally well in both geography and English. History, I found it really depended on the type of history. I remember taking one history course which was very much political history, events rather than people, the great man approach rather than social or labor history. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it was the first history course I took, and it really turned me off history. And I found I could barely read the textbook. It was so boring. But then I got turned... hope this is still not being taped.
It's funny how many people say that.
It completely almost turned me off history. And then as a graduate student, I got turned back on to history. I took a course from some of you may know of his work. He's done some work in British Columbia and on the prairies. I think he's more of a geographer by training. A guy named Arthur Ray. He's written a lot on the Indians in the prairies. And I took a course from Arthur Ray, who was more of a labor social history course. And then I took another course from a woman named Margaret Prang, who used to be the editor of BC Studies. And it was an excellent course. She was phenomenal. And she was just about ready to retire when I took the course, but she was still writing very productively. And she had a really good grasp of sort of the complete spectrum of history.
So it's not just the subject matter, though.
It's the way it was presented. And so I found my graduate courses in history were far, far superior to my undergraduate courses in history.
Well, thank you very much, Robert, for joining us today, and thank you. I'm wondering after viewing this video if every essay you get is going to cite Graham Wynn.
I hope not.
Thanks very much, though.
Okay, thanks, Will. Thank you.